bird singing in the dead of night.
Good morning, Colorado. This is Tish Buford, and welcome to Public Affair. This morning, we have some amazing guests in our studio that we are truly honored to have with us this morning. Most of you remember the tragedy of the Columbine High School massacre that occurred on April 20th, 1999, and it ripped the hearts out of the state of Colorado and people throughout the country and throughout the world. And in light of the escalating violence that we've seen over the last 19 and 20 years, we are blessed to have one of the parents of the, I should say, we have both parents in the studio this morning, of one of the students that were tragically killed in the Columbine shooting. We have Tom and Linda Moser joining us in studio today as our very special guest. In honor and in respect to those who have lost their lives to mass shootings and gun violence. Tom and Linda, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I know it's been almost 19 years, probably closer to 20 years, since Daniel was murdered. Over the last, I would say, probably two decades, how has the transition been of losing a child? This is something you never get over and something you never, you know, forget. But how do you deal with that today, and how much different was it for you back in 1999 versus now?
Well, I think the pain never entirely goes away. It certainly lessens over the years. I'm not sure that time itself really makes all that much difference. I think we've just kind of found ways to cope. You know, we try to embrace things that are life-giving. You know, we've relied on each other a lot. I don't know. Do you have anything to add to that, Tom?
No. No. I would agree with what you said.
Okay. There's nothing that really, I think, there's no magic bullet, you know, to cure this this grief. It's something that we'll just carry with us for the rest of our life. But we try to, you know, take from life what's good, and we try to give back, and that's about all we can do.
And I think the thing that Linda refers to this as is you have a hole in your heart. You really have a hole in your heart, and you know you can't fill that back in. But you try to surround yourself with some things that do make life better for you. And I think the thing that especially drives us is the realization that Daniel would not want us to be in this deep grief that we could never get out of. He would want us to find happiness in our lives and thrive, and still acknowledge him and do things to honor him, but recognize that he would have wanted us to have a good life after this tragedy.
And I do believe that the way to cope is to find positive things, and the amazing strength that you and Linda have displayed, like so many other parents who have tragically have had to have this imposed on them and thrust upon them with no say-so. And it is something that never leaves you, because being a parent is the greatest gift in the world, and it's the highest honor of the world. And anybody will tell you it is the most difficult job in the world. And you have two other children that are Daniel's siblings. Now, are these older or younger siblings?
We have a daughter who was 13 at the time of the shooting. Now she's 32 and married, and just gave birth to a daughter this past September. So that's been really wonderful.
Congratulations.
I've been up there three times already to visit. And We also have an adopted daughter who's just about to graduate from high school, and she'll be attending CSU next year on a scholarship. And, you know, she has really brought us a lot of joy. That was something that we knew we wanted to do fairly soon after our son was lost. You know, there was just such a gaping hole in our lives at that time that we knew that we had to somehow try to fill it. And our daughter has really helped a great deal with the healing process.
That is absolutely amazing. Now, through maturation of your daughters and your adopted daughter, it sounds like you guys have been able to lean on them as much as they've leaned on you for comfort and support to get through this life-altering situation. And how have your remaining children adjusted? How are they coping, and how are they doing now?
Well, I wish I could say it had been really easy, but it wasn't all that easy, especially in the beginning. When our son was shot, you know, our oldest daughter experienced some difficulties with bullying. I think at first kids were sympathetic, but then I think perhaps just because she got quite a bit of attention, there was actually a bullying problem we had to deal with at her junior high school. And we, you know, spoke to the administration. We couldn't get the situation resolved. And so she was tutored at home for the last half of her eighth grade year. And I can't help but say that we still have struggled with grief while raising our youngest daughter. And perhaps that has had some impact on her. These things don't happen, and there's no, with no result. I mean, these things don't happen in a vacuum, and they do impact the other people in your family. I'm just feeling very fortunate that, you know, my two daughters have seemed to come out pretty well-adjusted people, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, thank God for that. And Tom, did you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I would just add the difficulty that you can go through when you make that decision. So, in our case, to adopt, it was not too long after the Columbine tragedy that Linda brought up the idea of adoption, and I'm ashamed to have to admit that I was not on board at first. It took a number of walks around the lake at Clement Park before she convinced me, because of our age at that time. We were both 47. The fact that my father died when I was young, or when he was young, I should say, and I was young. He died at only 52. Yeah, I was a little bit reluctant, being already 47, to leave a child the way I had, without a father. But Linda prevailed on me and said, I think this would really be good for us. I think it would be good for Christine, our other daughter. And she said, I think this really be good and healing for us. So we did go through the process. We adopted a girl from China. And part of the reason for that is that we knew it would be a girl. So you wouldn't be making those comparisons, you know, boy to boy with Daniel. And also, when you do the Chinese adoptions, you can adopt at an age like 47 at that time. Whereas American adoptions, you pretty much could only get like an older child or a teenager. Linda felt strongly that we should raise a child from like being a toddler, and it worked out really well that way.
I'm glad to hear that this has been such a success for you. But did you feel, on some level, that it may have been too soon to have the discussion? So soon after Daniel had passed?
Oh, definitely. That was part of it for me too. Is it too soon? But then we discovered, well, but it's going to take a while for that adoption to actually take place. Mm-hmm. So that then started making sense that, okay, yeah, we'll have to wait anyhow, but let's get started on the paperwork. And then we can always pull out if we decide that, you know, it isn't going to be right.
Yeah, no, and as far as, you know, meaning too soon, of course, the process is long and arduous. And in some cases, it can take a year or two or even longer. You know, as far as having the conversation too soon, mm-hmm, did it feel awkward or felt like maybe some way you may have been betraying your son's legacy already by talking about adopting another child in that way? Did it just feel weird that way for you guys, Linda?
No, it didn't really feel weird. Of course, partly we were under a time constraint anyway, because if we didn't get the child by the time we turned 50, then we wouldn't be able to get a young child. So we did have a time constraint. I always just thought that, you know, our son would just want to see our lives continue. And, you know, if we could help a child, I thought that would be something he'd approve of.
Absolutely. And from what I've read about Daniel, he seemed to be a very just kind spirit, easygoing kid, and he was just friendly, you know, didn't have a lot of pretense about him, and he was just, he kind of went with the flow from what I've seen on post and your tribute to him on the website. I always say to people, you can look into people's eyes and see what's there. And he had a lot of joy. And a lot of spunk, from what I could tell.
Yeah, and people said about him, you know, I remember one person in particular said, I could tell he was just a gentle person, you know, just by being around him. And that really was Daniel.
Yeah, his face illuminated just kindness. He just looked kind and fun. And, you know, you could look at, children are special, and I always say, they are 10 times smarter than we are, you know? And that is the case now, because Children for Parkland in Florida are showing the country now and showing our legislators on a state and national level that they are here to make changes that have not been made in light of Columbine, Sandy Hook.
I'm so impressed with them. I really am. It just blows me away.
I was so blown away. I was just blown away to tears. Tears of grief for yet more lives that were lost, but tears of joy, because I felt that maybe this time we're maybe finally turning a corner on this and getting America's government and their external lobbyist, you know, affiliations attention, and maybe perhaps making some treadway on this time.
I really hope they persist. You know, I really hope they do.
I feel that they will, and I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful that they will. Now, we're going to continue the other half of this conversation, but before we get back to discussing the 1999 Columbine High School massacre that happened right here in Denver on April 20th, about 19 years ago, we're going to go ahead and pause for a station identification here real quick. Again, my name is Tish Buford. You're listening to KGNU Community Radio, and this is a public affair, and we have Mr. and Mrs. Tom and Linda Moser in studio. These are the parents of Daniel Moser. He was one of the children that were killed in the Columbine High School massacre back in 1999. So again, we're just grateful and honored to have you both, and you guys are just such lovely people. And we appreciate you coming out here on a weekday when it's 12 degrees outside. So we're going to go ahead and pick back up on our conversation before our brief break here. You know, Tom, as me and your wife were just discussing here, there's something different about this generation of children. You know, two things. They have social media on their side. When Columbine happened, we read about it in the paper, okay, and we read about it online, and we had our news cycles, but it's nothing like the 24/7 ticker that goes on now. And children are a lot more socially acclimated. And I think that's to their benefit, because
Absolutely.
This is something that in this day and age that legislators and other adults just cannot ignore and walk away from. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. It's such a different environment. The way that they get information around, and the way they can look at different sources and say, okay, what's going on? I read this, but then I read this. Okay, now wait a minute. I don't believe that. We need to do this, and here's how we're going to get in touch with other kids. It's not that sort of reliance on one stream of media like it was back in '99.
Absolutely. And the children have control over their narrative, you know. And so if you shut them down on Facebook, they can go to Instagram.
That's right.
They can go to Snapchat. They can go to Twitter. They can go to YouTube. They can make videos. There's so many different avenues of media to stream this information out. But the fundamental thing that I find so heartwarming through this gut-wrenching tragedy is that they're putting their foot to the ground, mm-hmm. and they're doing the old-fashioned protesting that was done by the baby boomers and men and women of your generation. How does it feel to see teenagers who are your son's age doing this in memory of their own classmates and administrators and teachers and past victims of mass school violence, Linda?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's great to see, you know, we're of the age that we remember the protests, you know, against the Vietnamese War and so forth. And I guess some people don't remember that. I was looking at social media last night and somebody was questioning, there was a walkout, I forget which high school, out east, but they had a picture of it on social media, and the students had just poured out of the school. It looked like practically every student was outside, and somebody commented, well, what good are these marches? You know, these kids just want to get out of school, you know, and I had to reply to that, and I said, you know, don't you remember the civil rights marches of the 1960s? This is a way to get politicians' attention. This is a way to get the attention of the public, you know, and I think this kind of thing can be quite useful. You know, I'm just all for it. I just hope that it can be remain organized. I know we've had, you know, a lot of different dates flying around for various walkouts and so forth. But in general, I think it's really a good thing.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Tom.
I was so moved yesterday, so enthused. I'm with an organization called Colorado Ceasefire, and we sponsored a lie-in yesterday on the west steps of the Capitol, and we had 17 people lie down in honor for 3 minutes, in honor of the victims of Parkland. But we had a really nice turnout for something that was arranged in a very short period of time. And it was so great to look out and see how many young people had come down there to join us in this movement, you know, that I've been in for the last 19 years. When you have a rally, I'm sorry to say, when you look out into the crowd, you're going to see old faces like my own. And here were all these young faces, something we had just not seen in the past. It's such a dramatic change, and it has so much potential to go in a new direction with their participation. And we at Ceasefire are really going to have to adjust to this now. We need to do more to invite those young people in and become part of our process. And we're going to have to listen to them. It won't be us telling them this is what's going on and what you ought to be saying. They're going to have their own feelings about this, and we're going to have to listen to them.
And it sounds like you guys are willing to listen to them, because the bridging of millennials and baby boomers may be the exact cure for what's been ailing this country as far as our, you know, neglect in addressing outdated gun laws.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that my generation failed. You know, we failed America and not not stopping this growth of gun violence. These young people, you know, they're very fond of saying, we're not here to carry the torch that you handed us. You know, we're going to go our own way. And I think that's great. I think it's important for them to say, no, we don't want a life where we're all armed and the only way to protect ourselves is to be armed. I think they're going to be saying, no, we don't want to live that kind of life.
Nor do they want to have to grow up, you know, figuring out what closet they're going to hide in, you know, just in order to get an education.
And I could not agree more. And I have been telling people, conversation is the key. Dialogue is the key. Without conversation coupled with legislation, we will continue to be a violent nation. We have to talk. We have to implement common sense, mental health measures, common sense, gun law, and legislation. I feel very strongly that if people educated themselves on both sides, we can make progress. But people are so siloed and so stuck in their beliefs that everything is, to me, been a reaction out of fear. So what do you say to those people who say, you know, this is tragic and we're sorry about your children, we're sorry about the loved ones that are lost, but changing gun laws are not going to help, because if someone's going to go out and kill someone, they'll find a way to get a gun illegally and they'll go out and find a way to inflict harm and death on other people. What would you say to that, Tom?
I would say that that fatalism gets us nowhere. And that's what it is. They're really very fatalistic. And rather than do something, they've just essentially surrendered. And we cannot surrender to that. We have to say, no, it has to be a different way. We can't. I mean, we got ourselves into this mess. When I testified yesterday, we had three different gun bills that went through the legislative committee process. And they were pro-gun bills, and all three were defeated, thank God. But, you know, we heard them say, we need to arm our teachers because this is the only way to go. We have to protect ourselves. But we've been trying that for how many years now? We've relied on guns and a very loose attitude towards guns for generations. It hasn't worked. To think that you just increase the amount is preposterous. We have to go in a new direction. And again, that's where I think it's so important to have the young people involved, because they're the ones who are going to say, yes, a new direction. We're not willing to accept this way you've been doing things in the past, because it's killing us.
Yes, literally.
Yeah, and I mean, even if it's only incremental, I mean, I'm willing to start with incremental, small changes, you know, raising the age of someone who's able to buy an assault rifle. I mean, at least, you know, it's something. We have to start something, because I've seen a huge difference in the culture since I've grown up. I remember when a school or a church was a place of sanctuary, and generally, I mean, there. Occasionally things happened, but generally you felt safe going places like that. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're into the territory of people speaking about gun-free zones, you know, in a derogatory fashion, you know, like it's derided now. Oh, you're in a gun-free zone. I mean, it's almost subtly blaming the victim. You know, I just think that's so wrongheaded, and it's not the way that the culture should be moving. We should be moving away from guns, not embracing more and more and more. And I just think we're really at a crossroads now. We have got to take stock and start stepping back off of some of this stuff.
I agree completely. And Tom, real quickly, before we wrap up today, can you tell the audience a little bit about the three legislative bills that were defeated in the Colorado Assembly yesterday?
Sure. All three bills are ones that have been up for at least the past 5 years and get defeated every time. One would allow any person with a concealed weapons permit to go into a public school with that weapon. So not just teachers, but anybody with a concealed weapons permit. Second bill would have allowed you to shoot somebody. The way that we have the Castle Doctrine, the Make My Day law, that you can protect yourself in your own home, would extend to businesses. So if a business owner felt that you were uninvited in their business and thought you would potentially commit a crime, and if they felt any level of threat, they could shoot you, they could kill you. And the third one would repeal the law that we passed in 2013 that limits the magazine size to 15 rounds of bullets. All three were defeated.
That is great news. And these bills, I'm sure, will reoccur and be re-presented.
In fact, all three sponsors of those bills, a number of us spoke and said, why are we seeing these bills introduced every year? You've seen them go down. There is no stomach for this. And all three sponsors said, we will be back.
And why do you think they keep revisiting this when it's clear that these legislative bills are not going to pass? Because, again, the public can't stomach the policy behind the legislation.
I think they do it because their particular base tells them to. And the lobby that they are responsive to tells them to do it.
And I could not agree more with that. So as we wrap up today, guys, if Daniel were with us today, what do you think he would give as far as advice is concerned in the climate that we're seeing now with mass shootings in churches and schools and movie theaters and other public domains? What do you think Daniel would say about what he is seeing today if he was with us? Linda?
Well, I think he would want us to step up. He himself was involved in the debate club and so forth. And interestingly enough, he was aware of the gun show loophole back in 99 that allowed guns to be sold at gun shows without background checks. And he even brought that up to his father. And so he was a person that was very in tune with the issues of the day. And he was pretty politically aware. And I think he would just say, go for it. The time is ripe. And we need to take action.
Okay. And real quickly, Tom, what would you like to add to that?
I think he would look and say, gee, there was so much attention given to Columbine, and it shook the nation so much, and yet look what's happened in the past 20 years that things have gotten so much worse that now it's happening in churches and shopping malls and other schools. I think he'd say that it's really discouraging. It's sad to see how much worse it has become.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you two have been absolutely delightful. It's been a pleasure and a deep honor to have you both in here. Tom and Linda Mouser, thank you so much for joining us in studio today. And thank you all for listening to KGNU Community Radio Public Affair. I've been your host, Tish Buford. Thank you for listening, and you all have a great day.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.